Let's tackle some tough questions.
Welcome to the Therapy Brothers podcast.
I'm Brandon.
I'm Tyler.
We're brothers.
We're therapists.
And we know recovery.
Bring your stories, your questions, your successes with real recovery.
Hey, Tyler, you ready to have some hard conversations?
Let's do it.
Let the Therapy Brothers podcast begin.
Let's do it, Tyler.
Before we do that, Brandon.
Oh, no.
I got something for you.
Oh, no.
There's a rat on your head.
April Fools.
April Fools.
I remember that day like it was yesterday. Like we were at a thrift store. We were at a thrift store and we were walking past. And this lady, we said something to mom, like, hey, it's April Fool's. And she's like, there's a rat on your head.
April Fool's. we're filming today. It's April Fool's today, Brandon. So I just thought I'd a little blast from the past.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, that's funny. It's funny. How do we remember stuff like that?
All things to remember from your childhood. Why
there's
was that
a rat on your head? And we both remember it.
So funny.
Way to pull that out. Yeah. April Fools. Oh, man. Yeah. Well, happy April Fool's Day to all those out there. All right. Well, should we just dive right in?
Let's dive in, Brandon. Okay. So all these questions today are coming from questions that have been submitted through the website, therapybros.com. These are some written questions. So we're just going to try to rapid fire answer a few of them today.
Yeah. So do you want me to fire away first?
Go ahead.
I got a random one. Let's start with this random one here. It says, this question I'm asking because I hope to become an addictions therapist someday. Have you or would you treat a sex offender? And would you talk about what hurdles, if any, you had to overcome emotionally in order to help a client who has, for example, abused a child or done something else which goes very much against your personal values? What say you, Tyler? That's a good
question. Yeah, that's a great question. Just going into the mental health profession, I remember doing my supervision when I was in graduate school. And one of the kind of assignments we had to tackle was, is there a population that you don't think you can work with? And I went to my supervisor and I told him that I thought, I don't think I could work with someone who sexually abused children. And then we had big, long discussions about that over the course of the semester. And lo and behold, what I do for a living puts this in the realm of actually doing work sometimes with sex offenders. Mm-hmm. And something that was really helpful to me in my supervision with that is that my supervisor did a really good job of helping me come to see that there's a balance between hating the behavior and not being okay with the behavior, but getting to know the offender. And without fail, when you actually start to get to know the story of the offender, you can humanize them. You can see them as people. You can see and hear the background that they've come from, and you can balance empathy for their story while also not accepting the way that their choices have manifested.
Yep, that's really well put. I agree fully. My first job in this field, trying to get some experience, was working with adolescent sex offenders. So these were adolescents who had perpetrated on children, which is very interesting because I was working with kids. Like, they were adolescents, 14, 15 year olds, and what they did and what they had done was horrible. Wasn't okay. Wasn't in any sense of the word okay. And in many ways, they were still kids. They're 14 and 15 year olds. And so I hated what they did and I could see them for the humans that they were at the same time. And what was interesting, almost all of them had been abused themselves, and they were just repeating patterns. And I'm not justifying what they've done. That's still not okay. But they still need help. They still need treatment. They still need support. So I was working once with a client years ago where I heard about, and this is a full adult male, I heard about some pretty intense abuse going on. And so I contacted the authorities. I reported it, made all these reports, and the client still wanted to work with me. And at that point, I had so much what we call counter transference going on with him that I had to refer him on to someone else. And I had a young daughter. I had young kids at the time. You know, I heard some things and I just couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. And it was okay. That's what I needed to do professionally for him to get better help rather than meet with me at that time. So I've experienced both. I've done both. And I think it's okay to be really in tune with yourself and, you know, where you're at and how you can help people. But people who have made horrific mistakes are still people and they still need help. So we as therapists, it's our job to help them. And hopefully we're helping them not repeat some of that behavior who has hurt the victims that they perpetuated. That they have perpetrated on. I keep getting that word wrong. So yeah, that's my two cents on that.
Good, Brandon. I just reemphasize the last part of what you said there, that sometimes the best thing you can do for a client is acknowledge that you're not the right fit for them too.
Yeah, yeah. And that's okay.
And it doesn't mean they can't get the right fit. It means that you're going to prevent them from spending more time and energy than they should with you.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. We want what's best for the client. So, okay. You want to do the next one?
Yep. So this one comes from Jacob. This would be really nice to have more context to it, but as a father, should and how do I disclose to my teenage children? I'm assuming this is about his addiction. This is about his recovery.
Yeah. This is a tricky question, not knowing all of the circumstances and what's actually going on. So I lean toward yes. And the reason I do is, like I got a phone call this weekend from a friend who is in recovery and is doing really well, whose son is starting to act out, a teenage son. And I said to him, I said, look, your experience with recovery can be one of the biggest blessings for your son. But that's going to require you opening up about some of the struggles that you've had. And you don't need to give details. You can be appropriate. But what that does for your son is it shows him, hey, I can make mistakes and I'm still loved. I'm still okay. I can bounce back. I can recover. I can move forward. So every kid is different. Every teenager is different. Their level of maturity, their level of awareness, what's going to be good for them is a little bit different. So that's why I say not knowing all of the things, it's hard to give a black and white answer to that. But I do lean toward being open about your life experiences and sharing the things that you've learned from those life experiences, I think can be really good for your kids.
I agree with you, Brannon, that every situation is a little bit different and you need to make sure that you're following what your gut and what your impressions are over all of this. I think what's behind the question that most people ask when they ask this question is if I'm ashamed to tell my children is the statement that's inside the question, then that's your work to do.
Yes.
If it's like, man, I don't know if this is going to bury my children too much, or I don't know if they have the template to hold this yet, that's a different discussion to have.
Are you self-protecting out of fear, or are you doing what's best for them?
Yeah. So the real question needs to be, what's in the best interest of my child? And if the goal, you know, if we want to, and here's just something to consider, that maybe one of the best gifts that any of us could give our children is the gift of a growth mindset, then you're sitting on a gold mine. Yeah. As you do your own recovery work, because recovery demands that you're in a growth mindset. So even if you're not perfect at it, you know, if you're going and talking to your children and saying, hey, you know, you don't have to include them. They're not your sponsor. They're not your teammate. You're there to offer your experience as a gift to them. They're not there to manage your recovery for you. But what's wrong with your kids seeing you step in with courage? What's wrong with your kids seeing you go to a meeting? What's wrong with your kids seeing you, you know, try and fail and get up and try again? Like, I guess it just depends on what you're trying to teach your children. But that is
what you're talking about right now is one of life's greatest lessons and most important things to learn. So depends on what you want to teach your children. That's one that you probably want to teach your children. And so it is a gold mine.
Yeah, it's like, it's in a certain sense, it's like that argument that people always have is, should you fight with your children? And there's factors that would recommend yes and no, right? It's like, if your kids never see you have a disagreement with your spouse, then they expect marriage to be bliss all the time. And then when it's not, they wonder what's wrong with them when they're married. But also, you don't want to be over the top in conflict all the time in front of your kids either. But if your kids get a chance to see two adults come together and make a decision, even though they might not fully agree on something, that's a gift that you're offering your children to learn how to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Show your imperfections some. And just be aware. Are you doing it out of love? I think you can also overshare. You can parentify your children. I'm using you to feel good enough, so I'm telling you all this stuff. Careful of that too. So just be aware of your intention as to why you're sharing. And if that intention is to show them and teach them this growth mindset, then absolutely. The other thing, Tyler, that I think we see a lot is, you know, a lot of times somebody's saying, well, this is my recovery. I'm embarrassed of what I've done. I don't want to talk about it. And a lot of times the partner is like, man, it sure would be nice for the kids to know. Sure would be nice for family to know what I'm actually going through, and yes, why the struggle and why things are the way they are here. And it can be beneficial to bust things open a little bit so everybody understands what's actually going on.
Yeah, I think that sometimes it actually helps create space if that's what your partner is needing. You know, like maybe she's feeling like, man, everyone thinks that I'm the bad one because I can't manage my emotions, but they don't know what I'm really going through. And, you know, and I really need you to tell the kids, not for the sake of like throwing yourself under the bus, but like it would create space to then be able to let the work continue to happen that otherwise there's not space to do. It adds a little bit of context so that the kids aren't there in the background going like, well, geez, I feel something wrong underneath the surface, but I don't know what it is. Is it me, or am I causing problems? Am I causing marital strife for my parents? Like, it's like, no, we're going through some really hard times. And some of those things are due to my decisions, and I'm responsible for taking over those things. And we're going to get through this, but no, this isn't your fault. And no, it's not your mom's fault. And no, it's not, you know.
Right, right.
Like that can actually be beneficial.
The feelings going on in the house and what's happening, like, I want to take accountability for and own. And how are you going to take accountability for and own those things if it's all secret?
Right.
You know, I would even go as far to say, Tyler, that young children can know something. And what I mean is that they can know that, hey, you know, I'm having a problem, or
mom and dad are working some things out.
Yeah, we're working some things out, and there is some struggle. So you acknowledge it instead of pretend like it's not there is better for the children. All right. Should we move on, Tyler?
Yep.
Okay. This one comes from Melissa, and it says, I would like to hear more about the woman when her partner has betrayed her, as in, why would she want to work at having good sex when he's looked at other women, especially when you're finally trusting him after 2 years and he lies again about looking at women. It feels impossible to ask us as women to keep going towards someone after they've crushed your heart with staring at other women. How are we supposed to grow old together if this is a constant maybe issue? Hope you understand what I'm asking.
There's a lot in that one, yeah. Brandon.
There's a lot in that one.
Yeah, this is another one that would be great to have on as a guest, because I hope that we're going to hit the direction of where she was coming from with this.
Right. It's and you know, where do we begin? Because there's a lot of things that we could dig into and dissect with this. Wondering about a lot of things, where his recovery really is. When she talks about looking at other women, what does that mean? But the question that I'm really hearing there is, and let's kind of go down this road, Tyler, is why should I keep putting myself out there? Like why do that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So why should I be keeping so out there? And the answer to that is, well, it depends, that maybe you should or maybe you shouldn't. You know, if you're trying to perpetuate helping things go right in your relationship and you're trying to be the very best person you can be, then your recovery, whether or not your husband gets any better, is to grow in self-confidence, to grow in competence, to grow in understanding who you are, and then to act as your best self inside the framework of the marriage that you currently find yourself in. And so it wouldn't even really be for him. It would be more for you, based off of your own decisions between you and your higher power as to how you can help invite things to go right for your marriage. So that's why you would do those things. And in putting your whole heart into it, if that's what is the right thing to do between you and God, that's where the success is it's in having put the whole heart in. It's not even in the outcomes. Now, the outcomes would be awesome if they came along with, you know, more fidelity, more intimacy, more, you know, honesty, all of those things.
So, okay, because you can't. Let me kind of distill this down and just kind of, I want to throw this past you. So if I don't want to look at divorce as an option, like divorce isn't an option. I got into my marriage, committed, I'm not getting divorced. So divorce isn't an option, but I also don't want to be close to somebody who hurts me and lies to me and acts out all the time. And they keep saying that they're you know, working recovery and getting better, but they're not. And they keep falling back into these old behaviors that hurt me. What do I do? And you just gave an answer to that. Tyler just gave an answer to that. So you're actually not as stuck as you think that you are.
But I think where you get stuck is you still want a different outcome than the one you're getting, but you can still find joy and suffer less if that's the situation. So in your situation, Brandon, I'm not going to get a divorce. I'm staying in my marriage. This is what's actually going on. What do I do? I think I look at that and I try to put myself in those same shoes and I say, well, I would try to experience as much joy and as little suffering as possible inside the reality of my situation. And the only way that I know how to experience the most joy and as little suffering as possible is to take full accountability for what I have control over in the situation, do everything in my power that's in that control, and then surrender the rest and give it back to something or somebody bigger than myself. And if do that, then there's peace.
There's peace. I'm glad you got there. If you can do that, there's peace. Nowhere in what you just said, Tyler, is there's not pain. In fact, it's very painful.
Yes.
To choose in or choose out. And when I say choose in, I'm not saying go try to have sex with them when you don't feel safe and go put yourself out there, allow yourself to get abused or hurt or whatever. And that's choosing in. That's not choosing in. Choosing in means I'm aware of who I'm married to, what's actually going on here, and I'm going to navigate this the best that I can to maintain my safety and my integrity and choose into this relationship, which is very different, or choose out. Either one of those can be excruciatingly painful. And, you know, nobody, well, I shouldn't say this. I shouldn't say nobody. There probably are some. But we, Tyler and I, are not telling anybody that you have to keep, you know, putting yourself out there to get bludgeoned, to get hurt, to get taken advantage of and gaslit. That's not recovery behavior on your part. That's not the right thing to do. What the right thing to do is when there's lies and there's deceit and there's betrayal, is for you to take a step back and do exactly what Tyler just said. What is in your control to show up the most powerful, at peace person that you can? And that might be some pretty big boundaries that need to come into play if you're in a situation with a person that can hurt you.
And I would add to that, Brandon, that inside of the scenario we're talking about right now, if I then look at that and I say, this is how I can grow more into myself, into knowing who I am, as I grow in confidence and competence, by nature of doing that work, whatever he does or doesn't do, if he notices other women or not, I am no longer tethered to those other women. I am no longer, they are no longer like a threat to me in the sense that like I know who I am. And so the pain, even though it's there and the distance in the relationship might still be there, I suffer less because I learn that I don't have to play the game of comparing myself to whatever those things are.
And that's not giving him a pass to go lust all he wants. That's not what Tyler's saying. Like what Tyler's saying is you get so strong that if he chooses to be unfaithful to you or not, you're going to be okay because you know who you are. And the consequences of that still might come. The consequences of that will still be there. In fact, they're more likely to be there because you'll be honest about how that affects you, but it doesn't affect you. It doesn't affect your self-worth. It doesn't rock your core of who you are. You know who you are independent of that.
That's right. That's exactly what I'm saying. So now, because inside of that question, I hear that, like, how do I lean back in when he's looked at other women? When he's looked at other women, it's like, when I get to a spot in my own recovery that it's his loss rather than I'm not good enough, then the suffering decreases.
Yep.
It's his issues. It's his sickness. It's his work. It's his wrestle, right? Like that's a him thing. It's still sad because I have to be boundaried and I probably won't be as open. I probably won't be as like, there won't be as quite the level of intimacy there, but it's not about me.
Right. Right. I do want to say, Tyler, this whole notion of divorce is not an option. Let's say I'm, you know, really religious or just have this belief that divorce can't happen. It's not an option. And I get in a relationship with somebody who is abusive, abusing the children, abusing me, you know, but divorce is not an option. Divorce is not an option. What do I do?
Yeah, you're left with one of a couple of other options, because if you can't get divorced, then you either have to change how you feel about it or you have to accept things as they are.
Yep. Or
stay miserable.
Or you open up divorce as an option.
Yeah.
You know, I know which it goes against, yeah.
It's interesting though, Brandon, that in mine and your experience, that it's funny that you don't want to go pursue it, you don't want to, but when divorce is an option, the people who get to that point and choose in then have power because it's the choice.
Because they're not staying because they're stuck. They're not working through this because they have to. They're choosing in. Which changes the whole dynamic of both recoveries. And it actually gives a lot more power and peace to both parties to say, look, I love myself enough to protect myself, And that I actually prioritize that self-love and self-protection and boundaries and knowing who I am and showing up authentically over our relationship. And when the relationship is at odds with what's really, really important to me, we either need to work that out or I need some distance from you. And if you do that again and again and again and again and again, maybe that distance grows further and further to the point of divorce. All right. You got another one?
Yeah, good one, Brandon. That's maybe one we should circle back on again sometime, or we get someone to call in and have that discussion with us. But yeah, this one comes from Diana. There's actually three parts to it, so we'll just maybe take one at a time if that's all right, Brandon.
Yeah, I already did the third one. So
the third one was oh, yeah. Okay, good. So the two. So we just have the two left then.
Yep.
Yeah. Thank you so much for what you do, for all your valuable content. You're both sensitive and sensible therapists. There's three separate questions. Number one, how do I break out of self-imposed isolation? After years of isolating myself, as well as constant traveling for missions work, which I don't see coming to an end anytime soon, I find I've no friends back home except for those in my 12-step program. It's good.
Yeah.
It's interesting because it sounds like this person they're really good at staying anxiously engaged in a good cause and staying busy, but not having many connections.
Yeah. I just think of, I would first ask why. So before we get into what, like, this is how you don't be isolated and this is what you do. I would ask the question, why are you doing this? Why are you feeling like there's a void in your life of connection? Why are you creating that void? What are you protecting? What's in the way? What fears are you having that's making it difficult to have deeper relationships with people? So I dig into that. Why? What's the trauma? What's the fear? What's going on that's isolating you? So I'd start there.
It's interesting. Yeah, and even in the question that we have, it's only like a sentence or two, but just, and again, I'm reading between the lines a lot here, but after years of isolating myself, as well as constant traveling for missions work, it's almost like the pursuit of the connection is coming through always being the one giving the service. Mm-hmm. And yet I don't have anything really to fall back on if I'm not anxiously actively serving others. That would be part of the line of questioning that I think you're bringing up, Brandon, is why is my connection one directional? What is it that I'm protecting? What is it that I'm running from? What is it that I'm hiding? What is it that I'm afraid of? That kind of stuff.
And if it is one directional, I mean, people get burned out with that. I serve, I help, somebody who sponsors, five people, but no one answers their phone call when they actually reach out. You get burned out with people when you're the giver, 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 giver. And yeah, that may be a reason why you're isolating or not wanting to connect to people, because you don't receive enough love and support back. You just give so much.
But you don't allow that either. You don't create systems or relationships. Yeah, to be the receiver. And that's the question. Like, why can't you be the receiver? Is that a self-hatred thing? Is that an unworthiness thing? Is that a learned thing? Like, where did you learn those kinds of things? And how is that playing out in your relationship? Or maybe you have a bunch of people that would be connected to you, but they never get a chance to connect to you because, every time they come to do something nice for you, you have to flip it on its head, and then they always feel indebted to you. So they'd rather just stay away. Because no one likes to go to a place where they feel indebted.
Right, right. It sounds like she has a lot of opportunity for connection.
Tons.
So there's an opportunity there, but it's looking at, what are the barriers in terms of the fears which lead to your behaviors that keep people at a distance? And it might be something as simple, now I'm going to get into the what a little bit, as simple as like opening up to somebody. Sharing your feelings with them, having fun, making some jokes, you know, those type of things that nurture and build relationship and friendship. But it might just to make a little, ask for help, make a little joke, open up, might be such an act of courage for you. Because you're not used to wanting to connect fully. You just give.
Yeah. And you could do that even on small levels, just for practice sake, crack a joke to the person behind the counter at Walmart, or when they ask if you want help with your groceries, even though you can handle it, say yes. Like start practicing. That's the what of the muscle memory part to go along with whatever the questions, the answers are to the questions that you get. You know, we're assuming certain answers in the advice that we're giving right now.
Just the other day, Tyler, I went to the airport, and the, you know, the pickup where it's like, if you stop for longer than like 2 seconds, like, you know, they're going to just freak out on you. So I stopped, and the parking lady was standing right there. And before you know it, like, I'm full on empathizing with her about her job and like her life. And, you know, we're having this like emotional connection, me and this parking lady at the, you know, and she's like, man, you're the nicest person I've talked to all day. And, and I just thought, well, I could tell like her job sucks. People hate her all day because she has to like hurry people along and this and that, you know? And so I just thought, I'm just going to like listen what it's like for her. And next thing you know, my van was parked there for like 10 minutes, you know, as I'm talking to her. I guess I'm telling you this, like, it's not hard to connect to people. It's not hard to make friends. You just need to want to do it. And you need to want to open up in order to do that. Okay.
I agree with you, but it's hard. It's hard when you're out of practice of that, Brandon. It takes sometimes some actual simple acts of courage, like you just described, to step into those places a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing. When you ask people about their life, how much they like that, you know, they'll open up and they'll share. And, but it's hard to ask to be heard. Like, let me tell you about my life, you know, can you listen? So, okay. Should we do the other one?
Yeah.
So the question is what kind of work should I do in therapy to help me overcome self-hatred rooted in childhood sexual abuse and emotional neglect? Talk therapy is no longer helping.
So, yeah, I mean, this goes along with kind of what we were talking about now, is that maybe this question answers some of the things we were asking in the last thing.
Yeah.
Self-hatred rooted in childhood sexual abuse and emotional neglect, you know, like,
and then she's wondering why she's not having more connection and why
I'm not able to reach out and connect with other people too. Man, think of the vulnerability that would take for a little girl who doesn't feel safe, even with probably some of the most primary relationships that she grew up with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what should she do for healing though, Tyler? She says talk therapy is no longer helping.
Yeah. Well, anyone who listens to our podcast, Brandon, knows that we're big into the kinds of treatments for trauma that include more than just the rational mind. We're talking, there needs to be new emotionally corrective experiences. And so the formal kinds of treatments that we know that do that are things like IFS, things like EMDR, ART, those kind of trauma-informed types of treatments. And the reason I think both you and I like those is because those treatments are whole body experiences. They're whole soul experiences. They're not just rational talking.
Yeah. Yeah. For deep trauma work, talk therapy is nice for one element of it. And what that is helping you get conscious of that things have happened. But that's just one part of the healing process, is to get conscious. So if you're doing talk therapy over and over and over again and just getting more conscious of your trauma, you're not actually going down and healing that trauma. And when Tyler talks about emotionally corrective experience, that it's hard sometimes to know, well, okay, how do I go have one of those? And there is opportunity, whether it's, you know, attending our retreats or a retreat, where you have experiential experiences, you know, things like plant medicine and holotropic breathing. Like, we could go down the list. And this is why Tyler and I do this type of work, because we know that it's essential to the actual healing of the heart. We know that it is. And so there is answers there.
I can't tell you how many times Brandon and I maybe had that. The trick is that sharing your story with somebody really does matter. But it matters even more if you share your story to a landing spot that allows for the emotionally corrective experience. So if I just go in and keep it all rational and tell my story and someone's like, okay, I heard your story, like, that's different than I go in and I share my story and that person holds the space and goes there with me and goes, wow, you must have experienced this and this and this, and you're still worthy of love. And like all of that stuff, that's a different kind of an experience. But I can't tell you how many times I've had clients, Brandon, where, and it, you could name the kind of treatment, but you know, they do 5-10 sessions of talk therapy only over their trauma. And then they do a single session of holotropic breath work or a couple of sessions of EMDR. And they come back and go, whoa, something's shifting. Something's different. Like, I don't know what you did. And it's like, we didn't do anything. Your brain and your body did what they were capable of doing, and they just needed a permission and a safe space to do it.
Yep. Right. Yep. You know, it's interesting, Tyler. We bring up all this stuff that we bring to our clients with the breathing and the plant medicine and the retreats and all this stuff. Like, I know for you, one of the most therapeutic healing things that you do is that you go for a walk with your dog every day. And that might seem like a little thing. You know, you walk in the mountains with your dog. Might seem like a little thing. Like, it doesn't have to be rocket science. Like, make some time to sit in nature and spend some time with God every day. If you haven't done that, that might be better than talk therapy right now. Sit in nature, notice the weather, breathe. Just do that on your own every single day. It could change everything. Exercising every day. If you're not exercising, just do something where you're moving your body and feeling your body move. And it might go against all of your trauma to move in that way. And that's exactly what you need. So have an experience.
Yeah, that's a great thought, Brandon. And hopefully that's helpful answer to the question there.
Yep. Well, Tyler, do you want to do one more? Should we wrap it up?
I think we're good. I've got one more, but I had one more, but you just kind of answered it. So I'll just throw it out there and then you can add anything else you want to, but you just kind of answered it with the last thing we talked about. Comes from Jeffrey, and this shout out to Jeffrey. I know who this Jeffrey is, and you're a good man, and I'm glad to see you here. But I can see most of my faulty beliefs. Why is it taking me so long to correct my black and white thinking or thinking errors to change them into positive thoughts? And I think what I would, at least part of what I think your answer to that question, Brandon, would be exactly what you just said, is that you've got to get out of now that you've recognized it, you've got to get out of just the thinking and into a different experience with the feeling around those thoughts.
You know, Tyler, last week I was teaching my groups the Kristen Neff's self-compassion stuff. And I noticed a pattern, and the pattern was consciousness first of the faulty thinking, and then connection to common humanity. So I'm not alone. Other people have felt this. And then the last one is compassion, self-compassion, and like, just, hey, can I just be kind to myself and be nice and be good? And so, you know, with that question, I can hear the consciousness. He's conscious. Now let's apply the common humanity. You're not alone in the way that you feel. It's okay.
He might need to put himself out there to connect with people that way too.
Yeah, exactly. Like, go actually connect. And then have compassion for yourself. You know, may I feel peace in my heart today? Can I feel gratitude? I'm worth feeling peace and love today. So you start to feed yourself those type of thoughts that helps you replace that those faulty core beliefs.
And you're doing it in an emotionally corrective way. It's not just, oh, there's my thought, I'm just going to change the thought. It's, there's my thought, this is my humanity, here's the feeling towards that thought. Now I'm getting reps in on an emotional level too.
Again and again, yeah. And then it does, you know, I don't want to regurgitate it, but his question goes back to the question before, you know, the answer that we gave, where do the deeper work. Once you get conscious, go do that deeper work.
Exactly. Good, Brandon.
Good job, Tyler.
All right, you guys, thank you for being here with us. If you do have questions, therapybros.com. We'd love to talk to you, but if you want to just write a written question, you can do that too. And I'm so glad you're here with us. We appreciate your support. Until next time, keep on keeping on.
Keep on keeping on.